Hi, it's Ariana.
Hi, it's Greg.
As a listener to Climate One, we know you care about how climate disruption is affecting all of us, now and into the future. I'm guessing you already do several things in the spirit of climate action. Here's another one. Giving a donation to us to continue bringing you shows about the causes and solutions to the climate crisis. You can do that at climateone.org/donate.
We offer all our podcasts and radio shows for free, but it takes time, effort, and resources to produce new episodes every week. When you give, you'll help us pay for the talented staff, equipment, and materials we need to make the show. And you'll join a group of other dedicated funders and community supporters who keep Climate One on the air.
If you're inspired by the guests and conversations we curate, please consider making a gift today at climateone.org/donate. Thank you for your support. And thanks for listening. This is Climate One. I'm Ariana Brocious. Last week, we hosted a slate of events as part of San Francisco Climate Week. Today, we're releasing some bonus content just for our pod listeners. We've got an excerpt of a conversation Greg Dalton had in front of a live audience at the Commonwealth Club with Alicia Seiger. She's a lecturer at Stanford Law School and leads sustainability and energy finance initiatives at several departments within the university. Greg began the conversation by suggesting that many in business and government use the term net zero without knowing what it really means.
You edited a book titled Settling Climate Accounts, The Road to Net Zero. That term net zero is important. We hear it from companies. We hear it from nation states, from governments. So it's one of these things that's thrown around a lot. And I'm not sure people really understand what it means. But what does net zero really mean, and how do we get there?
Yeah. Well, here's a confession. I don't know what it means actually in practice, which
Wait,
is partly why we,
it.
I know. Well, we wrote a book about how practitioners are going to struggle to make it add up. And so for those who aren't familiar with what net zero means, it's this idea of by a certain date, your net emissions you produce minus the emissions you remove will be zero. The term really launched into the sort of common discourse after the IPCC, the International Panel on Climate Change, group of global scientists published a special report on staying within 1.5 degrees Celsius. And as we explore in our book, we take accounting in sort of the triple sense of the word, looking at accounting as storytelling, telling accounts of the history of climate action, and then accounting as the technical exercise of bookkeeping, and then accounting with account as the root of accountability, and how are we going to make this all net add up. And so in understanding how we arrived at net zero as the dominant organizing principle of climate action, we looked back at the last 30 years of what's gone on, and just quickly, the highlights to note are the original idea was we were just going to have a carbon tax, right? We would put a price on the externality, and that would solve the problem.
But pay for pollution.
Right, pay for the externality. Governments around the world weren't able to get the political will and the consensus around that. And so drivers of climate action who emerged as corporate leaders and NGOs and investors started to try and take some detours here. And so the first detour was this idea of green finance, that we're going to buy our way into a stable climate by having the clean stuff cost less than the dirty stuff. And so that actually kind of worked in the energy sector. We now have clean power that is less expensive than dirty power. And we're seeing that with batteries too. But the problem with that green finance idea is that we've got all these other sectors, the economy, where it is more expensive to do the right thing. And so we had to make another detour, this idea of a turn to risk, which is this idea that if we invert the lens and we use risk as a means to reprice things, maybe things will work out that way. And that ran into challenges in that risk can be transferred, right? The state of California has been left holding the bag on cost of wildfires and disaster relief and healthcare benefits and unemployment benefits. So private sector can move that risk around.
Right. Private sector has been privatizing the profits and pushing the cost and the risk onto the public and the taxpayers, right?
That's right. And then you have these justice issues where if you look purely through a risk lens, you run the risk of climate redlining, where there are just areas where you don't invest because it's too risky. And so we arrived at net zero because it steers around these difficulties of green finance and risk. It sort of ignores the complexities of, you know, what Bill Gates will call a green premium of things that are more expensive. And in managing risk, it sets up this process of aligning emissions with normative targets that looks like risk management, but is a different exercise than actually managing risk.
Okay, so we started out to make green cheaper. That worked in some areas. Electricity from solar is now cheaper than coal. So it ended on net zero. You and your co-author wrote, climate accounting as a narrative falls into two genres, pep rally optimism and dystopian despair. Describe those narratives and what you think is the true story.
Ooh, yeah. I mean, it's hard, right? There's a wonderful podcast called Outrage and Optimism. Christiane Figueres is one of the co-hosts of that holds this tension well, because there is that you kind of need both. Along with that hope and despair comes heroes and villains, too, as part of the storytelling of where you want to hold up a certain set of actors and wrap them in green capes, and you want to give another set of actors, you know, spears and weapons. And the reality is it's much more complicated and nuanced than that, and some things that are done in pursuit of goodness aren't necessarily in service of the ends that we all are hoping for. And some of the actors on the evil side are responding to incentives and, you know, would, when they come home to their families on the weekends, very much like to be doing the things that would be in service of climate stability, but they have incentives and shareholders and stakeholders who are pushing them in other directions. And so what we really need to do is develop innovations and align capital so that there is clear, you know, incentives and price signals and policy that are steering us in the direction of decarbonization.
So what I hear you saying there is good people are playing a game in a system with the rules of which are not serving them or us well. We need to change the rules of the game because we have people who are nice soccer dads and moms, but they're going to work for fossil fuel and finance companies that incentivize them to do bad things because that's the game, shareholder value, right? So we need to change those rules and then those people will be able to do what they really are yearning to do.
Well, and by the way, it's not just the people who work for oil and gas companies. It's all of us, right? We buy plastics, we get on airplanes, we drive cars. Like we're all complicit in.
And we don't pay the cost of the pollution of our plastic.
Right.
Yeah, right. Okay. Right. Okay. So if we change the rules, then the people will follow. And you think that accounting is a way to do that. It gets nerdy pretty fast, but why does it matter? We need to change the rules and change the numbering.
So it does. I always like to tell the story about accounting because you may have all just fallen asleep as we said the word, because I remember my first year of business school, I came from a startup background and I was sitting next to one of my now dear friends who is a teacher, and we were a couple weeks into the accounting class and she turns to me and said, "I'm so glad we decided to take Mandarin," because we had no idea what was going on. So, I mean, I get it. It's not a sexy topic. It's not something people spend who aren't doing it a lot of time on, but the reality is now talk about handing out capes. Like I really do think accounting is the foundation on which we can achieve our climate goals. And so in the implementation of net zero, we have this tool of disclosure to try and make these targets line up. But there is a difference between disclosure and accounting. And accounting, again, at the risk of boring people, is where you count everything and only once using principles that have been used for centuries and battle-tested across all kinds of markets and market manipulation and globally standardized in practices that can be understood and implemented. And so once we kind of evolve our toolkit towards accounting principles, we can start to measure. We can, you know, the idea of disclosure is you manage what you measure, but if those measurements aren't auditable, you know, comparable, continuous, and specific, you can't employ the management techniques that one would like to have.
Right. So some people would say that more disclosure is always better, right? Because there's sort of presumption that fossil fuel companies are evil and doing things and kind of hiding what they're doing and not really disclosing like how much is going out the smokestack or how much are they dumping into a river. And so more disclosure is like, yes, disclosure is good. Bring transparency to this murky, evil world of energy. Do you agree that more disclosure is always better?
I think some disclosure is good. I think it quickly falls into a careful what you wish for kind of scenario. So when we were operating in a voluntary world with corporate leaders looking to make decisions about their products, you know, for material sourcing or the implications of products downstream or which suppliers on margin to choose from or what kind of energy to purchase, there was real value there. And I think that should be recognized. And when you're trying to decide where to locate the next infrastructure, having disclosure on physical climate risk really matters. It's going to change.
Where should we build this road or bridge? Is it going to be washed away by sea level rise? That sort of thing. Okay.
And there's increasingly now, both behind paywalls and thanks to Probable Futures and organizations like that, information on physical risk that's for free and available for governments to use. So that really changes decisions in capital allocation. Where disclosure, I think, can run into challenges is on the transition risk side, where you're talking about how companies and economies and countries move from high carbon intensity to low carbon intensity. And what we have been using is the Greenhouse Gas Protocol to furnish that information. And because the protocol was built as a risk management tool when we thought we were going to have a carbon tax, and you would want to know where your risk was coming from in these different, you know, your direct emissions or your electricity emissions or your supply chain up and down. Now we're in a different kind of context where we want to understand how to compare different companies, different products, different materials through a supply chain. And that's where disclosure isn't fit to purpose for the kind of capital allocation decision making that we are hoping is going to happen in the context of these disclosure regulations.
Does that position get you some flack from some people who are in your world who think that all disclosure is good? Has that lost some friends over
this? I have lost some friends over this, which makes me so sad. So just a little bit my background. I, as an undergrad, designed my own curriculum in cultural anthropology and environmental science and policy. I was really transfixed by this question of the relationship between humans and natural systems, and then businesses and sustainability, and now climate and capital markets. I serve on the board of an environmental advocacy organization. I have been everyone's green friend for 3 decades. I have some green cred. But what has emerged in the context of a much larger stage of political food fighting and distance from facts and, you know, fake news, you know, there's just a lot of noise out there. And so people are losing their ability, especially in the context of an issue like climate, which is really scary and urgent and existential, to hear new information and to receive constructive criticism or curiosity or questions that threaten the status quo.
We all have confirmation bias. We let facts in that support our worldview, and facts that challenge our worldview, we let them bounce off. We all have that.
Yeah, and it's totally understandable. And I think the important thing to articulate here is recognition of the incredible work that has gotten us to where we are today, and everything that has happened to date needed to happen. Like, that was all part of an evolution. And now we have an opportunity to evolve our toolkit and understand where disclosure is useful, advocacy, you know, internal decision-making, and where we need to continue to evolve into application of accounting principles for climate-related information. And one of the things in the context of your question that has become just a litmus test is scope 3, right? And you saw this in the SEC. You saw
so let's pause there and just define the scope.
Yeah.
These gets technical. It's actually very important. It's become actually dragged into the culture wars. So just define scope 1 and 2 and 3.
So scope 1 are direct emissions that enter the atmosphere. They happen when you burn, you know, fossil fuels, when you change land to, you know, when you're emitting carbon.
When I take a hot shower, if it's gas heated, then I'm burning.
Yeah.
I'm in the process of switching that to electric. But today it's gas.
Yeah.
Okay.
Scope
I'm taking
2,
a shower. That's my scope 1.
If you're gas heat, yes. Scope 2 is emissions from your electricity purchases. So it's indirect. So it's the utility scope 1, essentially. Mm-hmm. And then scope 3 is both upstream and downstream in your supply chain. So wherever you sit in a supply chain, it is both everything that happened before that product or service got to you and everything that happens
after. So the
afterwards.
Metal that's in the, if I have a water heater, I'm not sure this is the best metaphor, but I'm going with it.
Yeah.
You know, it's the energy that went to make the metal, right?
Yeah, copper and the steel and the trucks that shipped it around and the energy use of the manufacturing company. So what happens in the construct of scopes, which was a feature, by the way, when it was originally built, is you have this indeterminate overcounting. So you're taking scope 1 emissions through the supply chain and you're reassigning them with confusing boundaries and in a way that results in, it's not just double counting, it's an indeterminate overcounting, which, by the way, also happens when you reduce emissions. You get to count things a lot of times too. And so that was really useful when corporates weren't doing anything on climate, when we wanted to tag as many emissions as possible to companies, when you didn't have the ability to really measure and track emissions information through complex geographically dispersed supply chains. This was a good way to get started. But now that we're putting the pressure of moving from a voluntary system to a regulated system, and as we try and get from the billions of dollars invested to trillions of dollars invested, we need a more robust foundation.
You're listening to a special SF Climate Week conversation between Greg Dalton and Stanford University's Alicia Seiger. We'll have more after this quick break.
Hey, everyone. I'm Dan Kortler, the host of TED Climate. Each episode, we unpack the problems and solutions of climate change. This season of the show, we're getting into some big ideas that make us optimistic about the future, like meat grown from cells and leather made from mushrooms. And the best part? We look at how building a greener future can be an upgrade instead of a sacrifice. Find and follow TED Climate wherever you're listening to this.
So starting in 2027, companies operating in California with total annual revenues of over $1 billion will be required to disclose not just their scope one, but their scope two and three as well. This is a big deal. So how will California's new corporate climate disclosure laws change how companies are doing business? Yeah.
So I would separate them. I think there are two bills. There's a bill 261 that is a broader view of climate risk disclosure, which is based on the Task Force for Climate-Related Financial Disclosure, which requires companies to look at their governance, their strategy, their risk management, and then metrics and targets. That's going to, I think, change how companies do business because they're going to be forced to ask questions and staff up around climate-related conversations that just weren't forced before. Many companies are already doing that. But
most of the S&P 500 are already voluntarily doing
it. So it's just, you know, it's just building the muscles. The other bill is on the metrics and target side and is specifically related to disclosure of scopes of emissions. And my hypothesis is that the way it will change how businesses operate is that they will hire a lot more consultants, lawyers, and purchase software to furnish a mass confessional of information. But whether and how it actually changes capital allocation decisions is an open question. And I think what our research shows is that what you really need is accounting to be able to change the just capital allocation decisions. And the disclosure runs the risk of climate becoming a compliance function. And I'll add one more example to this. What you're seeing with the banks who are forced to disclose now financed emissions, which is a special category of scope three.
Right, so a bank lends to a coal-fired power plant. They have to somehow take a hit for that.
And what they will share with us in private conversation is that they're happy to play along. They're happy to get their gold stars and do the performative reporting because they're the big ones, because they can afford it. They learned this from Dodd-Frank. We can out-comply our competitors, and we'll hire a bunch of people, and we'll furnish a bunch of information. But that exercise is largely detached from deciding where and how to invest.
So it sounds like you're saying that there's been a whole measurement and disclosure industry that's grown up around corporate emissions. And you say that we might be doing a bunch of work, perhaps creating profits for software companies and lots of lawyers and consultants, and creating an industry and making ourselves feel good, and politicians feel like, hey, look at this. You got to lift up and show what you got. But we're not reducing emissions. We're not solving the central problem.
It's a very unpopular thing to say. Everyone wants to celebrate the good news. And I do too. And there are things to celebrate. But as someone who has the privilege to be able to observe what is going on and what is happening, what's not happening, and see the signal through the noise, we don't have a lot of time. Again, back to our book, like studying the last 30 years of climate action, it's not that people were with tented fingers going in the wrong direction. Like, they just were doing the best they could with the information that they had at the time and the conventional wisdom. And the role of places like the Sustainable Finance Institute is to really tell the stories, do the research and analysis, publish the information to more rapidly design the innovations that will keep us making progress as we work to stay under the deadline of the climate clock that's ticking.
Use the word performative, because we all want to think we're good people, that we're doing what we can, we're having an impact, and whether it's hosting a podcast or a radio show or getting a report on disclosure, that we like to think like, okay, I'm doing my part. Yeah, that's a win.
Yeah.
And you're saying that our performances may not really be doing what we think they're doing.
Yeah, I am saying that with love and kindness and compassion. And look, people are busy. They know what they know. They do what they do. It's hard to see the system. And again, that's the privilege of being in the seat that I have, is you can look at the systems. It's not that the performers are doing it with ill intent or doing it knowing that they're doing it for performance reasons. It's people are doing the best they can with what they've got, and they're busy and they're scared and all those things. Right. So it just comes back to an openness and a curiosity and a willingness to collect new information and to make course corrections. And this comes back to the broader tensions of being a human on this planet today, particularly in this country, of people just yelling at each other and not listening and getting in their camps and getting extreme and having litmus tests. And the polarization of our discourse and our societies has made this harder, because even within the environmental advocacy community, there's an unrecognized performance that is being perpetuated, because it's so hard to be in that group and be confronted with an onslaught of invitations, subpoenas to go before Congress and have to defend why climate matters.
So you teach at a law school and a business school, hard numbers. And there's a saying, if you can't measure it, you can't manage it. Though I'm in a business where I can't always measure the impact of this conversation or anything I do. And one person said to me, well, not everything important is measurable and not everything measurable is important. So how do you bridge those two things? We have things that are very important that need to be managed. And we also have some things that are important and not measurable.
Yeah. Well, so a couple things. That's a big question. I mean, I would say that on the measurable side, you need the accounting to get the measurements right, but that enables the accountability. And the good news is we're starting to see that. I mean, with the carbon border adjustments that have gone on in Europe, in the EU, that's pulling this accounting information through and holding firms accountable for their embodied emissions as they cross borders. California is a leader in climate policy that are holding various constituents accountable in various ways, whether it's mandates or bans on internal combustion engines or standards.
All very important stuff.
So we need it all. There's no one, the silver buckshot versus the silver bullet. And a lot of that does sort of have to come in recognition of the messiness of human behavior and psychology and how communications plays a role in storytelling. And we need people to line up in service of electing political officials who are open to understanding the complexities of the climate challenge and enacting effective climate policy that then aligns incentives to drive markets towards decarbonization.
Okay.
It's really easy.
The numbers are important to help align incentives, which help align us with our values and with our personal and collective interests. Yeah, sure.
And so what's so elegant is about accounting is, again, you can assign accountability. And so one of the things we've been working on at Stanford is, once you recognize emissions as liabilities and long-duration liabilities, you can start to implement the idea of a carbon balance sheet. And you can think of climate and carbon management as an asset liability matching exercise, where you're maintaining a carbon balance sheet. And that then is one mechanism that would endogenize the cost of the externality, so what you would have to pay to undo the harm of the emission, into capital allocation decisions. And so now, if you move to a system like that, which can only happen with the foundation of accounting, which is why we need to start there, you can start to redirect flows of capital at a massive scale because you have the incentives.
So if we get the accounting right, we can get the money moving.
Question. Yeah, can I add one more point to that? Sure. On the accounting? You don't just need the balance sheet, because even once you have the accounting right, you have competition to be the lower carbon supplier. And that's what we've seen through pilots of this carbon accounting work, is that companies, once they understand the embodied emissions in the materials they are procuring, they then set up supplier contracts to say, this is the number you need to beat. And companies are then competing to be the lower carbon supplier.
So you think that accounting can help reform and tame capitalism to stop it from destroying all of us and destroying itself?
And by the way, there's also the inconvenient truth that without a planet to operate on, without a stable climate, all of the assumptions that are embedded in any business's operation collapse in an unstable climate. And so that is something that people are increasingly coming to recognize.
Alicia Seiger, thank you very much for sharing your insights on measuring what matters and everything else.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. It was a pleasure.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a special SF Climate Week conversation between Greg Dalton and Alicia Seiger of Stanford University. Climate One is a production of the Commonwealth Club World Affairs. We'll be back with a full episode for you on Friday. Thanks for listening.